grant yourself the power to recognize your the things that make you heart happy and the ways in which you achieve them.
Kennedy Kanagawa is an actor, a singer, a dancer, a writer, and all-around brilliant human. He has worked everywhere in New York, including prestigious theaters like the New York Theater Workshop, York Theater, and Second Stage. He has played everything from Judas and Jesus Christ Superstar to Jack from Into the Woods. He has been in new workshop after new workshop and Zoom reading after Zoom reading. The bottom line is everyone wants to work with Kennedy, but that's not all. He also just recently was awarded the first award level in the National Alliance for Musical Theater's 15-minute musical competition for his 15-minute musical called Dungeons & Dragons the Musical. When I wrote the part of Kenny in Screen Test, I couldn't get Kennedy out of my head, and I was beyond lucky to be able to have him play the role on this film. He is truly one of the most inspiring and dynamic human beings I know, and he's with us today on the podcast. Welcome to The Break Breakdown, Kennedy.
Oh my gosh! That's so nice!
Anytime I do an intro, everyone's all surprised by it, but this is just like who you are.
I know, but like, it's just so flattering and like, wow.
Literally, Courtney. Dude, I pulled your resume. Like, that's it. Like,
there you go.
It's not nice. It's just what it is. And also, sometimes I feel like sometimes when people pull your resume, you forget. You're like, oh yeah, I did do all that.
Yeah, I was like, oh right, I did do that show. Aw.
Yeah. Oh, that was 5 years ago, which in quarantine times feels like 55. Speaking of that, before we kick it off, I just want to check. I feel like it'd be bizarre to not check in and just say, you know, it's a weird year of quarantine and the coronavirus and weird stuff going on. So just how are you?
Oh yeah, I'm good. I'm okay. I am really good at like, I'm a big introvert, so I'm really good at being alone. So mm-hmm. I feel very lucky in that I'm thriving in some ways with all of this alone time.
Right.
But also, you know, like the world is on fire. So mm-hmm. as good as can be expected.
Right. And I think that's the last conversation I had with Jillian. She's like, I'm doing well, but also there's all this other stuff going on. But I think that if you can take the stuff and kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say use it to your advantage. That's not what I mean. But just be like, okay, I accept this as it is. And how can I work with these pieces as I am? You can get to some level of making it through.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay, so you and I go way the F back.
We do.
Many years. We do. Uh-huh. I didn't even count the years because I'm not in the mood to.
We don't have the time.
We don't have the time. But we went to college together at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We were in shows together. I saw you in many shows. I feel like thinking about those years from our transition as a group of friends and a group of colleagues at college to a group of friends and colleagues in New York, I feel like those first years of transition were crazy and in a different way than things are crazy now. But I just feel like, you know, those first moments in New York couldn't look less like my moments now in New York. And so I've been thinking about that transition, that first step from college to New York specifically. But, you know, if listeners are listening, you could obviously make that parallel in your own life for whatever transition you made recently or in your 20s or whatever. But my question for you, Kennedy, is when you came to New York City after college, what surprised you the most about your experience specifically in the theater industry?
Gosh, well, we came to New York after graduating from this little liberal arts school. And I was shocked when I moved here at how little I was actually prepared for the practical side of the theater industry. like so much of my education was academic and theoretical, but I didn't have an audition book or know anything about anything. So that was a pretty jarring and very steep learning curve.
Yes. And you know, I for years was kind of bitter about that. But recently, and I don't know if you feel this way, but recently I'm like, wait a minute. That's the most anti-capitalist thing ever.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of awesome. Like, they were like, hey, this is how you think, and this is how you, and this is how you question things. And you know, here's how you can question your own assumptions. And that doesn't actually help you get the right 16 bars when you have 2 minutes to audition in front of Telsey, but it does, you know, give you, I mean, I don't know, I would argue it might give you the foundation that would be supportive of someone like you who has had, like, your resume, I feel like, has so much breadth and depth to it in a way that maybe wouldn't be cultivated for you if you were like, okay, I'm going to go to a BFA program and I'm going to be in for this part and do this. And here's my book and here's my resume. And this is, like, you know, kind of like a, what do I say? Like a factory, you know?
Oh yeah. I'm so grateful for the things that we did learn in school and the way in which it taught me to think even beyond just theater, but just in life. And I'm grateful for the connections that I made. I think that it's actually really rare that so many years after having graduated that our network of college friends are still so tight knit. I think, man, we really had to figure out for ourselves in the wilderness those 16 bar cuts.
Yeah. And those 8 bars sometimes. It's like,
sometimes right, 8 bars.
Which note would you like to hear?
Mm-hmm.
I'll hold it for you. I'll flip to the vibrato on the 4th bar and you can check out how I resolve it.
Thanks. You so much. I'll let in the next person.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Okay, so talking about community and all of that, tell me your experience with how to network, which I think is just like the weirdest word. And I think it's probably a provocative word. I feel like you can't say network in the theater industry without someone having a really big reaction one way or the other to it.
Oh, yeah.
So, right. So tell me about your experience with how to network and build a community while still staying true to who you are and not putting on a facade.
Yeah, I feel like that word networking is so, I have such negative connotations with it. And especially, like I said, I'm such an introverted person naturally that the idea of, you know, going out and schmoozing or, you know, being smarmy with people in order to get a leg up in our industry is so gross. And even more strategies that work for other people, like emailing someone that you haven't met, is terrifying to me.
Right.
And that works for a lot of people and it just doesn't work for me. So I feel like the way in which I have found community and the ways in which I seek out community is just so much more simple as just like being kind. I think that it's so important and so many people lose sight of the importance of being a genuinely nice person who is easy to work with. It's so important in the work that I do that the people I surround myself with are people that I think are good people. And because, you know, like, it doesn't matter how talented you are. This is New York City. Everyone is talented. If you're not nice or if you're irresponsible or unreliable, then you're not going to get recommended for things nearly as much as the 5 people who are just as talented, but are more enjoyable to be around.
Right. Right. And you know, that's so funny because when we were first in New York and I was like really hustling hard, auditioning all the time, I remember being like, okay, they need to feel like they want to work with me. Like, and I got to get them that feeling by walking in the room and just being someone who really feels like they, you know, oh, that girl would be really fun or whatever. And my interpretation of that, like, you can hear in how I'm saying that, like, clearly that's not someone you want to work with. It's like intense 24-year-old lady singing Gimme Gimme.
Yes, but singing it so well.
I mean, and then I remember one time I was speaking of Telsey, I was in Telsey and I forget who the casting director was at the time, but I was going in for the Addams Family and I for Wednesday, and I went in and I had a great, like, I sang my song and I felt great about it. I felt like I looked the part, and the casting director, like, as I was done, was like, as I was leaving, he was like, I really like your shoes. And I turn around and I say, I really like your shoes. Doesn't that just make you want to vomit?
That's so wonderful, though. I love that so much.
Like, I was like, I could have just been like, thank you, and left and maybe gotten to the next round. But instead, I was the awkward girl being like, and I remember his reaction being like, oh, okay. Because that's the appropriate reaction. But, you know, as a young one, I couldn't figure out why anyone would want to be around me if I didn't really give them a reason. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, well, people, I need to work hard to show people that I'm worth being around rather than just like being myself. And it sounds like that's what you're saying, is you're like, I'm just going to be myself in every situation. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be respectful, and I'm going to just build out one brick at a time from there.
Yeah, totally. Because if you're forcing a community or a group of people in the industry that you're surrounding yourself with through these, you know, by being on in a way or superficial, then ultimately those people aren't going to actually be your people if you're not being yourself. So how much better when you are yourself and you find the people that connect with who you are.
Right. I don't even think I looked at his shoes.
Oh, I bet they were fine.
I mean, they were probably fine. Anyway, that's one thing I'll never get over. I have many stories like that. But we'll leave that for another time. Okay, so, like, I don't, you probably will disagree with this statement, but I'm going to say it as fact. You are one of, if not the busiest people in theater I know.
Oh my gosh.
Don't even argue with me.
Not true. Okay.
It's my podcast. Don't talk. Okay. So, like, even during a quarantine, I feel like I can't even keep up with what you're doing. It's like, oh, Kennedy can't be at this, you know, whatever, because he has a reading. And I'm like, wait, I didn't know about that one. I knew about the other one. So, and that's all to say, like, that's not to, I mean, I'm saying that in the way that I feel like you're working hard. You're in the community. You've got your pulse on things. So I'm wondering, during this really strange time, how do you feel the fabric of the industry is shifting during this time? And where do you see it going once we come out of it?
I remain optimistic that, you know, we're in this very bizarre, surreal time. But I hope that this pandemic, and I think that this is the case because I am seeing elements of this in action, but I think that this pandemic is forcing us to stop quite literally and allowing us to gain some much needed perspective as an industry. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if we want to go there, but I feel like the entertainment industry in general, despite its liberal leanings, is ultimately a product of a culture that struggles with issues of racism and white supremacy. And
correct. Yeah.
I think that this period of quarantine and stillness is an opportunity for reflection and a kind of incubation, so that we can ideally emerge from it with a deeper understanding of the importance of diverse voices and stories and faces. And that's something that I loved so much about Screen Test, is just the thought and intention that was put into casting so many diverse people and voices and faces present.
Thank you. I feel like, so I think this thing that you're bringing up about reflection is so important, especially for artists who feel like they have to just push out material, mm-hmm. you know, and or actors who have to just book. And there's a fear, I think, or at least, you know, I guess this is coming from me. I can understand when people would have a fear of not stopping and reflecting, and of not just stopping, like the word stopping, you know, taking a break. It used to feel, in the old world, it used to feel like failure. Like, mm-hmm. why do I have to take a break? Why do I have to stop and like re-engage with myself again and re-engage with these ideas again? And you know, what's funny is, as far as like the racism goes, that's inherent in, you know, this industry, whether it's conscious or not. I mean, this is what we're learning, right? Is that racism is actually not a bug, it's a feature of the system. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to be anti-racist, you have to actively seek out all the places in which something is racist and then, you know, root that out. And that includes even the most liberal spaces. We're not beyond that at all. And what's really interesting to me is, I think that there was, from a producer standpoint, and I'm not close with any Broadway producers, so like this is my perception and maybe I'm wrong, but I think that people just often thought like, okay, this white story told by these white people are going to sell the tickets to other white folks. And not that it was even that conscious, but just that, you know, like equity in roles was not seen as a moneymaker. But what's really interesting is when I started looking into the film industry, I was looking up, I was like, I really want to know what's going on with women and people of color in the film industry. And I don't have the stats on me right now, but the, like in the past, I want to say 5 years, I'm butchering the stat. Premise is the same. In the past 5 years or something like that, when there have been more people of color in main roles and more people of color on set in creative and crew capacities, the box office numbers are better. So not to say that not everything is about capitalism and making money, and I'm not saying that, but like for all of the structures that used to hold before this pandemic, actually having an equitable workplace like leads you down the path towards making money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's lucrative, baby.
It's lucrative, baby. And like, again, I'm clearly not all about like capitalism and all that, but there's no good reason. There's literally no good reason to be racist. Like there's just no good reason.
This is correct.
But okay. So I hope that happens too. And I do think that there's a shift in the industry. And, you know, when I was talking to Sarah on a different episode, she was saying she was seeing a lot of, you know, people's stories being told that didn't get a chance to be told before. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to make us all as humans just better.
Yeah.
Just better. Okay, so Screen Test. So I wrote this and I obviously named your character Kenny, which is like three letters removed from Kennedy.
Two.
Is it two? Oh yeah, the D's. Wait, right?
Yeah. One E and one D.
All right.
Well, I will just say also, I received an email today from someone who spelled my name K-N-E-E-D-Y. Neat. Yep. Which, if we want to delve into that, we can as well, but that's for another podcast.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. So when I was writing it, you were the only thing in my mind. I was like, and then Kennedy will say this, and then Kennedy will sing that. And I was like, okay, Court, look, you can't get attached to Kennedy. Like, you can't get attached to him as playing Kenny because, like, he's working all the time. He might not want to do this. It's, like, super scrappy. Like, he doesn't, you know, you just got to be okay. Like, is this character okay if someone else plays it? I was like, no. Okay. Yeah, someone else could play this. So you were literally the first person that I asked to be in it, and you said yes, and I was like, okay, great, like, we've got a film. So
that made my heart so happy.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, I was like, I said to Allie, who I've mentioned her on other podcasts, but if you haven't listened to those, she's the costume designer for this and also one of the producers on it. And she was the one who told me that I needed to get my lights and sound right, that I better come correct about my lights and sound, and kind of kicked this whole thing off. So when I told Allie, she was like, oh, yeah, like, if Kennedy's in, we're good. Like, we're golden. We're good. But Kenny, the character Kenny, I don't think is like you. I'm not like, oh, this is Kennedy, but reflected in a character. But I would love for you to talk a little bit about the character of Kenny that you played in Screen Test.
Oh, Kenny. you know, I feel like there are two kind of diverging ideas of who Kenny is. Like, who he is deep down and how he maybe presents himself to others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at his heart, I think that Kenny is this sweet, sensitive musical theater nerd that struggles with insecurity and a need for validation. But it's just that he maybe seeks that validation by kind of existing in this, like, constant state of larger than life in your face belting.
Right.
Which might be, I mean, to some people, a little grating. Maybe.
Oh, man. You know, when you describe him like that, all I can think of is my Adam's Family on there.
Wait, that is exactly something that Kenny would say.
Right. Well, I mean, all of these characters are me, right? Someone on set was like, who do you identify with most? And I'm like, well, sure, I want to say Olivia, but actually, let's just go through them line by line and I'll tell you which one I've said out loud.
I think, yeah, everyone can identify with these characters. Like, I am a sensitive musical theater nerd that struggles with insecurity and validation. Like, come on, are you kidding?
Yeah. Yeah. And belting. You just always break out into a belt.
And I'm just always belting in your face really aggressively.
Which, by the way, before you... So this podcast will air before the film is released. So in case you haven't seen the film, but you're listening to this... there's some singing by Kenny. And before the first take, Kennedy, before, I don't know if you were aware of this when it happened or if you were in the zone, but before your very first take, where you started out the take with some singing, I leaned over to Lily, our sound engineer, and I was like, heads up.
Oh, no.
I was like, heads up, loud noise coming through. Like, it's not going to be the same level of speaking. And she was like, oh, man, thank you so much for the word.
Oh, no. That's
no, great. It's so great. Oh, my God. You're so funny. You're so funny. Okay, so tell me how you prepared for this role.
I didn't have to do much.
You basically just sang that. I don't have to do much.
Basically. You know, I, like I said, I very much identify with maybe who Kenny is on the inside. So then I just kind of channeled a manifestation of those insecurities and need for validation as, you know, like for anyone that is in musical theater and has ever gone to any audition ever, like that guy with a capital T and a capital G, that's like super performative and like warming up at like full voice, making sure everyone knows that he's friends with the monitor and talking very loudly about his recent credits to probably nobody, but also to everybody.
Right.
And I've gone to a lot of auditions, and so I am actually very familiar with that guy. So it was just a matter of bringing him out, bringing out my inner that guy.
Your inner that guy. Yeah, because we're all that guy.
We're all that guy deep down.
Do you think that Kenny wants to be on this reality TV show that he's auditioning for more than he wants a Broadway credit?
Ooh. Yeah, I think ultimately it doesn't matter what he's doing as long as he gets to be in the spotlight. Like, Broadway is definitely what he has like wanted since childhood. But if he gets to be on this TV show, are you kidding? He would take it in a heartbeat.
Right. Right. And he would be unbearable.
Oh, gosh. Just the worst. But there would be an entire Facebook group devoted to fans of Kenny that's got thousands of people in it. Half of them, I feel like, would like him ironically, but...
Right. Right. I love Kenny. I really do. I feel for him because because I am him. Okay, so I know your acting work beyond just screen test, and you're dynamic and beautiful in all sorts of ways, gentle and you know, like you can be, I feel like I'm going to say the word tender, and I don't mean it. I feel like I don't want that to sound like a bad or a weird thing, but you have the ability to bring so much sensitivity to any role. And so with comedy, I'm wondering, do you approach that any differently than you approach other kinds of roles? And also, I just want to know what you find funny.
You know, I don't know that I do approach it differently. I think that ultimately a sense of earnestness is really important for a character. And if it's a comedy, it's oftentimes the earnestness of a character in contrast to the thing the character is being earnest about, or the way in which the audience can relate to whatever the character is being earnest about that is funny. Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's always about sincerity.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you find funny?
Oh my God. I don't know. I find everything funny. It's kind of a defense mechanism. Look, I'm laughing. What am I laughing about? I don't know. Everything's funny.
Yeah. Well, that's actually kind of funny too, because Jillian and I were talking about the coping mechanism of humor that she used. And I'm like, oh yeah, I mean, that's my role, baby. Anytime we need a punchline, I'm there. I'm right there.
I feel like a lot of theater kids are drawn to this art form as members of the, just the outcasts and the ones who are othered in various ways. And I think that collectively, humor is a defense mechanism that we all use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember being in high school and the first time I did a play and going out to the like going out to get French fries afterwards with the cast. And I remember distinctly sitting across from people that I went to high school with that I never got to hang out with, or I never ran in the same circles because like just nothing, never did. I don't know what reason, right? Like I was always in dance. And so this is my first time in theater, whatever. And I remember having that distinct realization that this was where I was supposed to be. Like, I remember everyone laughing and talking over each other, but like just because we were so hyped up because like we opened the show or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And that feeling was, I mean, that feeling was college. Like when I went to college, I was like, see you later, high school. I'm all set. I found my people, you know?
Yep.
And I think there's something, and you know, even within the theater industry in New York, I didn't always feel like I belonged in it. And I still have those feelings of being an outsider, but it's different than what it was in high school. You know, in high school, it was like, I don't know, it was something really clicking and being like, I can feel safe here and I can feel like people care about me for me and not like, you know, whatever facade I was putting on in high school, you know,
yeah,
like kids totally. Do. Yeah. Hey, let's talk about rejection.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Speaking of high school, I feel like it's one of those things that it's one of those things where people, whenever you're going to go into any kind of art form, people are always like, oh, just there's so much rejection. Like my grandmother, God rest her soul, when I told her I wanted to go to college and be an actor and that's what I was going to do. And, you know, she was alive. She passed away when I was a junior in college. So she saw me do that and saw me in shows and all that. When I told her that, she said, oh, Courtney, it's such a hard life. No. She was also the one that told me that being flat-chested was en vogue. So, you know,
great.
She had her opinions and we loved her for them. But, you know, I feel like everyone has that story of going into the arts and someone being like, well, you know, there's a lot of rejection. And it almost makes it a shallow thing to say. Like, I know there's rejection. I know I'm going to get no's. And it's actually the experience of rejection, I think, is so much richer than that. And so I guess I'm just wondering what your experience with rejection has been as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, there is, I feel like in school, whenever there was, you know, someone from the industry that is, you know, talking to us, whether it was in college or a seminar or a workshop, I feel like they are always like, kids, there's a lot of rejection. If you can see yourself doing anything else, do that instead. And, you know, I remember hearing all of that and being like, well, not for me. This is the only thing I could ever do. I'm going to be on Broadway. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I still had no idea how much rejection. Theater is basically rejection and then a little bit of performing on the side.
Right.
And you're going to, and, you know, why do we go into theater to begin with? We are seeking validation like Kenny. But, and so if you're being rejected, you know, auditioning is such a vulnerable experience. You're literally presenting your entire raw being to a panel of people who are judging your being and telling you whether or not it is worth it to them. So, of course, when just with the sheer numbers, the majority of time you're being told you're not worth it to them, it's going to hurt, especially if you're sensitive. Mm-hmm. And you're always going to spiral about it. But then when you're, you know, when you're finally given the opportunity to work and tell the story, it's the best feeling in the world. At least for me. I don't know. It's so worth it in the end. So if you can kind of balance, it's something kind of masochistic about being in the arts, but if when you balance out all of the pain with the value, when you actually do get to do the work, if those scales balance out, then it's worth it. But if it's not, then go be a doctor.
Like friends that we have who've done that. Yeah. The other thing is, I don't know about you, but there was a period of time when I was auditioning all the time and I did not work for 3 years. I didn't step foot on a stage for 3 years. Did you ever have a period of time like that where you didn't?
Yeah. I quit performing like 3 or 4 times. The rejection got to be so much and so depressing and would just be eating it away at me so much that I was like, oh, well, that's it. I'm going to figure out something else to do. And actually my 30th birthday, I did a little cabaret where I sang a bunch of songs, and the intention that I had behind, and I'm laughing now because it's so absurd to me, present day Kennedy, but the intention behind that was like, well, this will be my last performance and I'll do this one night of singing this cabaret and then I'll be done with the arts.
Yes.
I didn't quit the arts and here I am on a podcast about the thing I made with you.
Yeah. And that was a great, oh God, you're so beautiful in that cabaret, by the way. But I also think, you know, I don't know. I'm not trying to sugarcoat. The 3 years that I spent not working were the hardest years of my professional life. And I've had some low moments, but I'm like, wait a minute. But then there were the middle 2010s. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't want to say that the 3 years that I didn't work were fine, because then I ended up working again and I got, you know, to do an off-Broadway show and I started doing commercials and I, like, those things are true. But I think also as an artist, you are like, if you want to be an artist with a capital A, that is more interested in like the art that you make than the dollars that you earn. And I don't think it's as simple as that, right? I don't think like you're either a good artist who doesn't want money or a bad artist who does. I'm not saying that at all. I think that it is a balance and it's a dance. And it's one that we're always kind of navigating based on the project. And I think people should be paid equitable wages and, you know, all of that. But I do think that there's a lot of work to do if you want to be an artist whose principle is, when I do finally get on that stage, let me tell that story as purely and as, you know, I guess elegantly as possible, then you have to kind of live a full human experience. And the full human experience includes 3 years of people saying no thank you, or like getting close to something and being like, this is going to be it. This is going to be my big break. I mean, those 3 years, I had so many Broadway callbacks and no Broadway credits. And it was almost worse to get that far, because I was like, you think I'm just so good, but not good enough. And, you know, older and wiser, it was probably a lot of things. It was probably like, yeah, that note didn't sound as well as good coming out of your mouth than someone else's, but also maybe I was like 2 inches too tall or 2 inches too short or whatever it was, you know. But this rejection is also like sometimes so random, you know. It's not personal, even though it feels personal, and reconciling how personally and sensitive we have to be in life as an artist, and also not taking everything personally, I think is such a difficult dance. But then if we can move through it, one that we can take on stage with us.
Yeah. Yeah. What you were saying about being, having those years of rejection kind of under your belt, and it does give you dimension as an actor, but also just as a person. Mm-hmm. And it also, and for those moments where you do feel success, whatever, however you may define that success is that much more sweet, and you're able to appreciate it that much more.
Totally. What about theater has broken your heart, and what has repaired it?
Oh man. Gosh. Well, I feel like everything that we've been discussing about rejection and the system of white supremacy in our country, it's all full circle. I'm hesitant to use the word heartbreaking, but it was definitely disillusioning when I moved to New York and really grasped the full weight and importance the industry puts on type.
Right.
Like, I'm an actor who is short, slight, gay, and Asian American. And not just Asian American, I'm biracial. So my father is Japanese and my mother is white. So in the musical theater canon, I moved to New York and I was like, oh, there are literally no roles written for me. So, and casting directors, who I might add are always white and usually men, constantly pigeonholing me as not white enough for this role or not Asian enough for this role. Like, I'm too Asian for The Music Man, but not Asian enough for Miss Saigon. And so to cast me in an established piece in a role that was originally for a white actor, like, that is considered a choice, and it's considered non-traditional. And you know, it was just exhausting constantly having my racial identity designated for me and differently each week with each audition.
Yeah. Did people tell you that? Really? Wow.
In fact, the agent that I was with right after graduating college told me that I needed to, and you might even remember this, change my last name from Kanagawa to something that sounded more white, because then I might pass more as white and get more work because of it. And, wow. You know, I was just a kid, so I did.
And wait, you did? I don't remember that.
Yeah, I went my mom's maiden name, Wiltshire, for maybe like a year or two. And it was so icky and not who I am. And I'm no longer with that agent. And I no longer have that last name. But
wow. Yeah. That is so aggressive. And like you said, you're just a kid, you know, 21, 22 years old. Like, you're just going to do what people say. They're going to say, these are the rules of the game. I mean, that's so gross. And I'm sorry that someone led you down that path. But also, then how did you decide, like, no, I'm going to be me? Like, what was that transition like?
I mean, I think, you know, I was born in Japan and lived there until I was 10. I have dual citizenship. I speak the language, and I very much feel that heritage is a part of who I am. And so to erase that aspect of my name felt like such a metaphor for trying to erase it from my identity as a whole. And I eventually just realized that it was gross. And I kind of didn't care if it wasn't going to get me as much work.
Right.
And I thought it was more important to be who I, like what we were talking about earlier about being mm-hmm. your true self and not being superficial. I decided to stop being superficial and own my identity.
Which is doubly impressive, maybe isn't the word, but like doubly meaningful when we're all just trying to learn how to be ourselves. You know, everyone's like, just be yourself. And you're like, I'm 22. I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
And then also have like the racism aspect on top of it being like, no, 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 but don't be yourself. You know,
right.
I mean, I faintly remember that, but I really don't remember that. And I'm glad you're Kanagawa.
Me too.
So obviously, you know, this podcast is about the making of Screen Test, but I also wanted to frame it in a larger context of breaking into the industry, mainly because I have never made a film before. I never directed a film before. And so, you know, if I'm going to talk about the film industry and this film that I did, I wanted it to be authentic. And so, I feel like an outsider as always. And I, by the way, when I say that I feel like an outsider, that's kind of like, I'll always feel like an outsider. And it's kind of my thing. mean? Like, it's not like boohoo, she's on the outside. It's like, you know, I'm always peeking around the corner. Like, what are you guys doing? I don't know. About that.
I love that image.
Yeah. But you know, the idea of breaking into an industry is also something that I'm like, yeah, I want to break in, but I also want to get into the industry and then like mess it all up. Like I want to like,
yeah.
change
good
everything from the inside out. And so it got me thinking about what are big breaks? What is getting a big break? And are we right now in a moment in time, specifically in 2020, where your big break actually means something else than maybe it did in 2018. So I guess I'm wondering how you would define a big break. And do you think it has the same significance or weight as maybe it did a few years ago?
It definitely has a different significance to it. You know, I think that we so often think of our big break as this singular mammoth kind of unattainable goal that is very distant and nebulous. And I feel like I've learned that it's so much better for your heart when you realign your perspective of what a big break is as more incremental successes that have more to do with your heart than with your resume.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're heart happy, then that to me is the success. Cause I feel like, you know, when we were talking about leaving the business as we both attempted to.
No. I was not trying to leave the business. I was very much trying to get into the business and the business was like, no, thank you, Ms. Romano, next.
got it. Well,
just wanted to clarify. I am a loser.
Cool. No, you're not.
I mean, you know.
Oh no, you're an outsider and you claim that title
yeah.
and I honor it.
Yeah. thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I feel like at all, like it's a good lesson for Kenny, you know, like you don't need to wait for validation from some pre-established authority, which, you know, in this industry, if we're being honest, is probably going to take the form of a bunch of old white dudes
mm-hmm.
and like grant yourself the power to recognize the things that make you heart happy and the ways in which you achieve them.
Yeah. What makes you heart happy?
Making things. I said that and I immediately judged myself, but I really do mean it. I love making things and like making things with my friends. Like making Screen Test was such a heart happy experience. Oh my God, I'm also a loser.
That's why we're friends.
Oh, you and me, two outsiders in the big city.
Just peeking through the gate. Yeah, no, I agree. Making things. I feel that if you're an artist and you're called to make things, like meaning, I don't mean called from like a higher power. I mean from the inside out, like when you're making something, you're in the flow and things yeah. align in weird ways that you couldn't anticipate and you couldn't calculate. Then if you're someone like that, and you know, spoiler alert, I actually think everyone's like that to a degree in different ways.
Yes.
But if you recognize that in yourself and then you go through a period where you're not making, it literally eats your entire life alive. Mm-hmm. Like I am a better wife, a better mother, a better friend, a better daughter, everything when I'm creative in some capacity. Like even like right after my daughter Elle was born, I was just like writing a little bit of poetry and that's all I could do. Like this, all I could do. But that act was somehow connected to who I really am, you know? And
yeah.
it was like my little lifeline, you know, to remember who I was in the midst of this huge life change. And I asked you the question, now I'm answering it. I think the big breaks come from, I agree, like from those heart happy moments when you're tethered to yourself and you're like, I am me. I am being me. I am existing with whatever impetus I was given inside this body when I came to Earth. Like this, I am acknowledging it. I am allowing it. And I am, you know, lifting it up.
Yeah. It's like what you were saying about when you are making things, it makes you better and better for the people around you. It's like being such a stupid metaphor, but it's like, it's kind of like being hangry, like creatively. Like yes. You gotta feed that part of you or you're not going to be as pleasant to be around.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Like, yeah.
And also, I just want to say that I love your poetry.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, having a baby is poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also an interesting time too, because like I had not been doing a lot. I mean, I wrote poetry when I was in high school and I like dabbled here and there. I would write Craig poems when we were in a really tough spot. I would be like, well, maybe a poem will fix it. And I'd write him these like really weird poems that didn't make sense and were full of metaphors and that were mixed metaphor. They didn't, if you read them now, you're like, was she on psilocybin? What was going on? So anyway, my point is like, I didn't really do that much. And then Elle was born and it's really all I did creatively for like 6 months or so. I even tried writing. I did some edits on some pilots I had written and I did some editing and stuff, but as far as new things, so it's almost like too, like when you get stuck somewhere, there might be a new medium to try, which I actually think is that an experience you have had, because you do everything. Like I didn't even say in the intro, you've done video editing. And I'm trying not to say that because I know that's not like, you're not like, I don't think that's where your passion lies, but you're an amazing, like editor, and you directed, by the way, my book trailer. So like, you're also that, I mean, you're so many things. Do you feel like there are certain phases of your career or your life that bring you towards different mediums and theater is always the constant, or how does that play out for you?
Yeah, I feel like creating in general makes me heart happy, but theater is in the closest, most inner orbit of my heart, but it's kind of like what ever. Sometimes it's, you know, phases. Like, I was really into bookbinding for a hot second. I like made Allie, the producer, a baby book. Like, I bound one for her
shower. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't made a book since that. So that was probably a phase. But yeah. And, you know, in quarantine, you kind of have to make do with what's available to you. So I had a moment where I was like, ooh, I want to learn how to sew. But apparently all of the sewing machines in all of the world are unavailable. So I haven't been able to do that.
Tried to buy one or rent one?
Yeah, literally, like every individual sewing machine brand website and like Amazon are all sold out of all sewing machines. We're in a sewing machine drought right now. Wake up, people.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. And I need that to be some kind of content. I need you to be like an angsty sewer who can't get his machine.
I am. That is exactly who I am.
That's who you are.
You keep writing these roles for me that are just me.
I'm like, Kennedy, let's just have you do a show and it'll just be your Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. So as I was preparing for this, like sometimes quotes or books or ideas come to me as I'm thinking about the questions I want to ask. And Robin Williams kept coming to my mind. Do you like Robin Williams?
I love Robin Williams.
Yeah, like I didn't know. I feel like he looms so large. I mean, mm-hmm. everyone basically loves him, but I didn't know if you had any connection to him or to his work, or you just love him.
Yeah, no, he's actually my my second cousin. Did you not know that?
Wait, are you serious?
No.
Oh my God, screw you. You're such an actor and I'm so gullible.
I really thought
that was, I was like, oh my God, I'm psychic. I literally had a moment where I was like, this is great. I just found out I'm psychic. All right. So you like him. No, it's fine.
Whatever. No, I just really like him.
Okay. So I like him too. So I found this quote from him about comedy and I felt like I want to read it to you and then I'll ask you about it on the other side. Okay.
Great.
This is Robin Williams speaking. For me, comedy starts as a spew, a kind of explosion, and then you sculpt it from there, if at all. It comes out of a deeper, darker side. Maybe it comes from anger because I'm outraged by cruel absurdities, hypocrisy that exists everywhere, even within yourself, where it's hardest to see. So I want to know if you think there's a dark side of ourselves that's in service of laughter and joy and buoyancy. And let me start with that question.
Ooh, these are great. gosh, that's hard. I think it can be. Like, I'm hesitant to say yes as like a blanket statement, but I certainly think that, you know, many of us use comedy, like we were saying, as a tool to heal or to cope with being othered or outcast in whatever capacity. I also feel like it's important to honor your darkness and kind of hold space for that shadow self. Oh my God, I feel like we're casting spells right now.
Oh,
just great.
We certainly are. Yeah.
Everyone that's listening right now is going to turn into a frog. But I feel like maybe a way of honoring that dark part of yourself is through the laughter and the joy and the buoyancy. So it's less of a covering up or a masking and more of a emission, just in a different form.
Right. Because it's not like darkness doesn't always reveal itself as dark. You know, right. Lightness doesn't always reveal itself as light. You know, it's there is something funny about tragedy. Like, it's a thin line, right? Mm-hmm. There's like some Charlie Chaplin quote. I don't know if you know this one, but it's something like tragedy is zoomed in and comedy is zoomed out of the same moment, kind of a thing.
Totally.
That makes sense. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, we're all of those things all at once. It's why you can be sobbing because something awful has happened and one little thing can happen and you can go into laughter and having a laughing fit at the absurdity of it all and then go back to crying. It's like all of these extremes are inside of us at all times and we're constantly trying to manage them and they're just unmanageable to a degree. Mm-hmm. Like they just are what they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when we can make other people laugh, what do we get ourselves when we're able to make other people laugh?
Well, you know, when we're talking about this idea of darkness and light, I feel like when I get someone else to laugh, that is, I am receiving light from that person. So if we're kind of constantly balancing these poles in our psyche of lightness and darkness, and you're able to share light with someone else through laughter and joy and buoyancy, then great.
Well, you know, it's like someone said to me, I put something up on Facebook. I need to get off Facebook. It's just like, it's the worst thing that's ever happened and I need to get off of it. But I put up something a few weeks ago or months ago, just being like, hey, I'm feeling terrible. And if you're feeling terrible, you know, you're not alone. And someone wrote on my post, I had this, you know, feeling last week and I'm feeling actually kind of okay today. And so we'll work in shifts. And that has been with me since he wrote that, because and it's kind of what I'm hearing you say now is like we work in shifts, you know. It's like,
yeah,
I'm gonna work to bring that laughter out of you. That's going to reflect back on me, help me for a little bit, and vice versa. And we're just here to like help each other through in shifts.
Absolutely. In fact, again, mentioning Allie, our friend who also worked on Screen Test, we have a joke I feel like that we've joked about since college where we are always at opposite extremes. So it's like, wait, am I having the bad day today or are you having the bad day today? And yes. We gauge and we adapt and share light as we needed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. Craig and I were like, we were both having a bad day yesterday, I don't know. And and we were like, oh, wait a minute. No, it's your turn. Like, we had to actually choose which one of us could wallow.
That's so great.
I mean, like, only because we knew whoever, I think, like, he got to wallow. I was like, all right, okay, today's not my day to wallow. But when I get my day, man.
Boy, will I.
I will go there. This is great. I feel like I really can't tell you. Let me just end by telling you. I can't tell you. Let me tell you. Craig and I watched so many, like, I was going through the edit and I would every so often of Screen Test and I would every so often be like, what do you think of this? Or like, I'm thinking of that, blah, blah, blah. Or I would just be in the room watching it and working on it. And Craig would be around and kind of looking over my shoulder. We have not stopped laughing at your performance of Kenny, and we have watched this thing like a million times, obviously, because we're editing. I was editing. It is so good. You are so funny. You are literally one of, I don't know if you feel this way on the inside, but from the outside, you are one of the most solid people I know, one of the most beautiful artists I know. And I just hope that we work together again and again and again.
Oh, thank you. I cannot wait. We absolutely will.
Okay. How can people find you online and where should they go to find out more about you?
Well, you can find me. This is ridiculous. You can find me on my website, which is my name, KennedyKanagawa.com.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Courtney.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode, the best thing that you could do is share it with someone. Either text it to a friend who might really enjoy this episode or share on social media. You can tag me at Courtney Romano or at Queensbird Films. That always goes a long way. It means so much. You can also leave me a message, and I hope you do. You can do that by following the link in the show notes. Leave me a message with your thoughts on this episode or another one, some questions you want me to answer, or anything else you want me to know. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.